Ciencia de la Evaluación del Impacto y Teoría del Cambio Social. Ha publicado en varios journals, incluyendo Public Understanding of Science, Culture and Psychology, New Genetics in Society y Psychology in Society. Sus libros más recientes son The Therapeutic Cloning Debate, por el tema de la formación terapéutica, Global Science and Journalism in the Public Sphere, y también Culture and Social Change, Transforming Society through the Power of Ideas. Y su libro próximo a ser publicado, que es un poco el contexto de lo que nos va a hablar hoy día, son From Conservation Education to Public Engagement, Research Principles and Practice, y Making the Most of Public Engagement Events, Research Principles and Practice. Oh, it's the same title. I'm on the Cambridge University Press. Y día está con nosotros para presentar un trabajo titulado Representing Science from Public Understanding to Public Engagement. Eric me ha pedido hacer una forma poco convencional. Va a haber una primera parte de 15 a 20 minutos donde hablar sobre el rol de las universidades públicas. Y eso nos pega de cierto coletazo. Texto de todo este discurso de Rector Sánchez sobre la vocación pública de la Universidad Católica, que sigue siendo una universidad privada. Entonces, terminada esa primera parte, vamos a dar un espacio para preguntas, y después viene una segunda parte que tiene más que ver con el rol de la universidad en el involucramiento ciudadano de la gente, digamos, en la ciencia. Lo dejo con el teoría.
Gracias.
Va a hablar, la presentación va a ser en inglés, pero la sección de algo de español de castellano habla, así que la sección de las preguntas pueden hacerla en castellano y va a tratar de responderla.
Sí, hablo despacio. un parte del contexto que debo decir es casi todo de las universidades en la Inglaterra son públicos. Entonces, es parte del contexto que necesito. So, I'd like to begin. The first part of my presentation is going to focus on the role of universities. And there have been some interesting things happening in recent years with the role of universities in the United Kingdom, where I work. I'm originally from the United States, but I live in the UK. I moved to the UK to do my PhD, and I've been there for almost 11 years now. And with the kind of spread of neoliberalism in general around the world, one of the effects has been on universities and the idea that universities cannot be a kind of good in themselves. They need to justify themselves in terms of the benefits they hold for society, especially the economic benefits they hold for society. So this is a kind of general move that has affected countries around the world. It's kind of affected them differently because of the different economic structures in different countries, the different political realities in the different countries. But I think the UK story is an interesting one. And what's happened in recent years is that UK universities have had to face the question of justifying their existence, because they are almost all publicly funded and they use government resources, they get funding from the government. They need to justify themselves and what good they're doing for society to deserve this money from the public. So the kind of, this term neoliberalism translates, right? Everybody's familiar with neoliberalism. It's basically this is the kind of the impetus, neoliberalism, and the problem is that often the kind of concern to justify institutions like universities has focused on economic impact. But one of the interesting developments in the UK is that there's been a broader definition of what kinds of value universities could provide for society. So the focus has not only been on economic impact, but also on social and cultural benefits from universities. But this also raises questions, because you can't just say The universities are having social and cultural benefits. That's great. Keep funding us, and everybody's happy. Necesita evidencia. Entonces, hay más problemas. So the first issue is kind of what's the relationship between universities today and the kind of good they serve for the public. There are different kinds of good that have been discussed with relation to universities. One is that they promote human and social development. Primeramente sobre los estudiantes, el desarrollo de los estudiantes. And so that's one area. Another is the kind of knowledge that they produce through society, for society. So that's through research, primarily. And then the thing that is the kind of that's talked about the most by government is the value of universities for economic development and for creating employable, flexible workers. So the thing that kind of makes this a public issue is that government money is at stake. And so universities need to be able to justify themselves not only to students, to say that they'll benefit students who come to them, but they also need to be able to justify themselves to the public in general and to government to justify the contribution. And research on public opinion about universities suggests that, at least in the UK, people tend not to think about universities that much, but when they do expect that there should be some kind of public benefit, that universities don't have a kind of right to exist and take public money just because they exist. They need to be able to show they have some kind of social return on this investment that the government, that the public are providing. And in the UK, university education is subsidized by the government. Is it subsidized here? So this is another kind of reason why the government is has an interest in sticking its nose in to what the universities are doing and finding out what's going on. But also, the government is pouring in quite a lot of money. In recent years, in the UK, there have been massive cuts because of the economic downturn, but university budgets were protected because specifically of the expectation that they were important for economic growth. So this kind of adds additional pressure onto universities to be able to justify themselves. So the benefits of universities, because a lot of those benefits are seen to be indirect and intangible, things like having a university kind of means you have more people who are more well-rounded. Students who attend university have a range of different benefits from attending, not just employment. And so there's a kind of challenge around how do you evidence that and how do you articulate that kind of benefit. So the kind of claims about what university education provides for a society is that it's supposed to improve the kind of economic structure of the society, make it more flexible and adaptable, to improve workforce flexibility. People go back to university to retrain, that kind of thing. And it's also supposed to have these kinds of general social values of promoting social cohesion and values, that kind of thing. The research side of what universities does, the kind of creation of knowledge, is also supposed to, in terms of justifying the investment in them, it's supposed to have benefits for economic and social development, but also for kind of the general benefits to society of having well-educated people walking around in society. And this is recognized internationally, this idea that supporting higher education will have broad benefits for the economy and for society more generally. But in recent years, this question of, okay, you claim that universities are really beneficial, how do we actually know that they are? this question has risen in importance as money has gotten tighter, and so universities have needed to justify themselves much more. And in particular, this kind of social function of universities and of the knowledge that universities create has become a big focus. In the UK, there's a kind of national research assessment exercise that happens every 6 years, where every university academic, including me, has to submit what we think are our best four pieces of academic work from the last 6 years. And this gets assessed systematically through a peer review process by other academics or specialists, and it gets ranked. Our contributions get rated in terms of the quality of the work we've produced. And then those rankings translate directly into the funding that comes to our departments for the next 6 years. So we just went through one of these exercises, and there was a big change this last time, where instead of it being solely based on the quality of our research, there was a new dimension that was added, which was called impact, impacto. And in particular, what they mean is impact outside of the academy. So part of the decision-making about how much funding universities would get was determined based on the kind of evidence they could provide that we're providing benefits beyond the academy, beyond our publications, beyond our role teaching students, that we're benefiting the broader society out there. And so this kind of raised questions about what kind of evidence, what does this look like, impact? How do we know that there's some kind of benefit, social benefit beyond the academy? And there was quite a lot of debate about what constitutes, like what should universities be doing? What kinds of benefits should they be offering? What kinds of knowledge should they be producing? And so there was, there's been a lot of theoretical work about, and social scientists have been quite heavily involved in kind of trying to rethink the traditional model of communication from universities to the broader public, that you have public relation departments that push out press releases. This is the kind of old model of how universities communicate with publics. And instead, there's been arguments, especially from social scientists, that there should be a more dialogical, two-way relationship between publics and university experts, in this case, not the institution necessarily, but the research groups and that kind of thing. And so the specific ways that this happens varies depending on the university and the institution, but the idea that there needs to be a change and that there needs to be a better relationship between the public and experts is something that's become quite well accepted in Europe in general, and in the UK in particular. And there are many different kind of stakeholders, participants in this process. So these are kind of different categories of institutions and people that a researcher might engage with, like schools, NGOs, businesses, so a whole range of institutions outside of the academy would be relevant. Also, participating in research that affects government policy would be in this category as well. So this idea, which has become known as engagement, public engagement, in the context of Europe, has been accepted by universities. So in their official statements about what universities should be doing, in recent years they've changed these statements to have them include these ideas about reaching out beyond the academy. And that there should be a dialogue between people outside of universities and university researchers, so that the kind of research that's done in universities is more beneficial for society, and not just kind of exploring interesting ideas for their own sake that may never actually find their way back to benefiting society. So this kind of movement and the kind of theoretical arguments about how this relationship between experts and public should work has played out well beyond universities. I wanted to start with the university example, but it's also affected institutions like museums and other kinds of places that kind of hold knowledge that's displayed and communicated to the public. So I'm going to shift to this kind of broader discussion and debate after this, but I first wanted to open up for a bit of discussion about your thoughts on the role of universities and what you think universities should be doing. So, dígame.
Da sociedade. Passa muitas vezes que a universidade se queda como ensimismada, considerada em si mesma, e a sociedade não sabe o que se passa na universidade, é como um trânsito de informações de ideias. Né? Então, isso pode, talvez essa política inglesa pode gerar mais trânsito de ideias, e assim a universidade não se queda translada. Eu vejo com simpatia esse tipo de coisa. Entende como.
No. Lo siento.
Basically, reason with
universidades. Oh, okay. ¿Piensas que las universidades necesitan comunicar y, con los públicos?
Sí, tiene que tener más tránsito, información de ideas, ¿no?
O sea, yo creo que es como una tensión de dos cosas, por un lado. Por un lado está esto de que haya más engagement, y al otro lado, eso se produce a través de mucha governmentality, que es como una discusión que hay harto en sociales en Inglaterra, como Stephen Boyle, Collins y toda esa gente, que ve cómo se domina mucho a la universidad y se introducen con el age index y todo eso, produce cierto como amarre de la universidad que tampoco le permite mucha autonomía para pensar los tópicos. Entonces, es como un problema, cómo enganchar a la universidad sin tampoco someterlo.
I think I understand. So one, definitely there's been resistance to this change in universities because of concern that it's kind of the imposition of neoliberal values on practices in universities. And that's a very reasonable concern. But actually the specific way that they've gone about the accountability measures, which definitely look like governmentality, are actually not that bad. They could have decided to use things like age indexes, bibliometric measures that kind of completely ignore the quality of work and only look at how many times things have been cited, which would be the easy, efficient, and probably the most neoliberal option. But they decided not to do that, and instead they used a traditional peer review process. So sociology work, research, was judged by other sociologists in the UK. And then the impact measures, also because they could have gone for a very simplistic economic measure of impact, and certainly they considered doing that early on in the process. But they ultimately ended up using a case study model, where universities put forward a certain number of case studies, depending on how many academics they had, that kind of made the case for why there was social or cultural or economic impact from this work. So my own I was submitted in both elements for my research to be assessed, as well as an impact case study based on my research that that I do with public engagement institutions like science museums, zoos, and science festivals. So it's there was a risk of it being very problematic, and I would argue it actually was pretty useful, because UK academics, in my opinion, when I arrived in the UK Academy, I found them a little bit too comfortable just sitting back in universities and chatting about things and not actually doing anything useful for society. So I've found it a valuable shift in the climate towards at least thinking about, okay, somebody here in this department should be doing something useful for society. There was, resistance, but I think it's a good shift. But I'm in the minority in my department in that opinion. Did that answer your question?
Yeah. I don't know if you want to about English or Spanish?
English is mejor para mí.
So I think there's a paradox in what you say, because when you talk, you said about, like, I think this was science, what you were talking about, but not necessarily university. Because why I think that? Because you can say, all right, so we have a university and we have, like, a department that can apply this kind of knowledge, like education, museum, I don't know. But you can leave alone science and just do science, right? Mm-hmm. Like the classic discipline, like, I don't know, science maybe in the future can be applied in. So I think there's a paradox in what you say in this kind of matter. So I'm not really sure what was my opinion about this problem, because I think like Leidendorf or Erzkovich's Trip Ellis's models about like science in one way, economic for another way, and I don't know what's the one, but like and the public part. So it's I think in practice, if you measure like papers in a public sense, you are like criticized science, not university. I don't know why, because university can resolve the problem doing something else, but not necessarily measure its own science. I don't know if I explain good.
I don't know if I fully understood, but I mean, this particular issue is relating to university researchers in general, but it's been a real problem for humanities researchers because they have a harder time making the case that their work has broader benefits. If you're if you're doing 17th century literature studies, it's a little bit difficult to make the case that this is going to have broader benefits for society. Much harder than if you're working on the latest smartphone technology, for example. So they have often tended to go the direction of communication, of holding events or participating in museums or things like that, where they can communicate the kind of insights from their research to a broader audience. These issues apply in science, arts, humanities, social science. It does apply to different subjects in universities and also that exist outside universities. But it has affected them differently in different disciplines.
Okay.
you mentioned something about peer review process and, mm-hmm. and evaluation of academic performance and mm-hmm. such, and you know, which is seems quite you know, thoughtful from coming from academic to academics, which is not really the case here. We mainly judge on very strict indicators of performance, basically impact factors and so on.
Okay, right.
My question is, what sort of element of audit culture persists in this new ways? I knew about audit culture was a big word in the University of the UK maybe 10 years ago. Now maybe it's more talking more about managerial ways of running departments and also precariousness and chunk and such.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to ask you that, what sort of elements of audit culture persist in the system you reviewed?
Well, I mean, this is the process of the research assessment exercise is very much an audit. It's definitely an audit. But of course, you can do audits in many different ways. And thankfully, there's been an acceptance that impact factors are a bad measure of impact, actually. Even academic impact, they're a bad measure. They're just too simplistic. And so, in general, those are not used in either by universities or by the government to judge the quality of what people are producing. So there is definitely an audit culture, but there are many steps. So I don't have a direct relationship with the government's audit process. The government commissions a process of peer review that only happens once every 6 years, and then universities make sure that we're producing something so that they have content to provide. And so it kind of filters down so that I know I have to be producing research at least 4 items every 6 years, which in my opinion is not very much. I do more than that every year. So it's for me, it's quite easy. But there are internal processes to check, to review work, but it tends to be quite constructive because everybody kind of wants the same thing at the end. We have review processes and we get feedback from both people outside and inside the department on our work to help develop further and that kind of thing. So it's... it is an audit process, but it's an audit process in the sense of like a class has an audit process for students. You know, it's not just about auditing them; it's also about helping. So, I think it's reasonable. You would get a different answer from some of my colleagues who feel it's unreasonable and.
It's also generational.
Yes, there is. Yeah. It's true. Yeah, my older colleagues are much more unhappy about it than the younger colleagues. It's definitely something that's worth reflecting on. And when it was first suggested, it was much worse. It was much more neoliberal, much more problematic ideas that the government had initially. And then there was a lot of resistance. And then the thing that came out at the end was actually, I think, fine. So it does, it's been an interesting process. It's just finished last year, and the results were announced at the end of last year. And so they're, you know, it's another 5 or 6 years till the next till the next round.
Is that independent from your personal?
That's a good point. Yeah, that it is. Yeah, so our departments will ask us what are we producing, but the review is blind, and also the results are at the department level. So my department has 30 university, you know, 30 professors in it, and we have no idea which of us got better results than the other, which is important. Otherwise, it could be much more competitive. They use a very similar system in Australia. It's a little bit more neoliberal in Australia, a little bit more kind of invasive as well, but it's quite similar. Anything else anybody has to say about the role of universities before we move to the broader? Okay. So, I'm now going to kind of shift to the bigger picture. I do research in a lot of different settings where there's kind of some form of expert knowledge that's being communicated to publics. So most of this work has been in the area of public engagement with science, or public understanding of science. But I've actually done a lot of research in recent years on how publics respond to art galleries, literature festivals, a whole range of different kinds of settings where people encounter unfamiliar concepts and ideas, and I'm interested in how they respond to those kind of unfamiliar ideas and either accept them or reject them or whatever. So this discussion is going to focus around public understanding of science because that's the most well-developed area in terms of the research and theory. But there are similar issues across a number of subjects, including public engagement with the social sciences. So this term is used to refer to quite a range of different types of activities, including mediated forms of communication between publics and experts. And the most important theoretical idea that's developed out of mostly sociological research on how people respond to scientific ideas, how the general public respond to scientific ideas, has been a shift from the kind of old model of how science communication should work, which has been described as the deficit model. It's a focus on what people don't know. And so if only you could fill people's heads with knowledge, they would agree with science and they would be compliant, helpful, and want to keep funding science. This concept has been rejected, both theoretically, empirically. It's been shown to be incorrect from research, but also in policy. So public policy has also recognized that this is a flawed model. So this model is the idea that what's needed in order to, that basically it kind of sees the public as irrational, emotional kind of actors who don't know anything. And so the general public out there are kind of naive, they're gullible, susceptible to misinformation from mass media, from the news. So this is seen as the problem, is that the public don't know enough. So research looking at this showed that, first of all, the general non-expert public actually have a lot of important forms of knowledge. For example, if you're a farmer, you might not have any university education, but you have a great deal of knowledge about the kind of microclimate in your particular farm and what's going on there, and other things that are directly related to your practices. So a kind of classic research study in this area was conducted with sheep farmers in the north of England, and this was a region near to a nuclear power plant, and there was some suggestion that this nuclear power plant might be leaking some radiation out into the environment. But the government said, it's a government power plant. They said, no, that's not happening. There are no leaks. The reason that there is some radiation in the environment is because of the Chernobyl nuclear disaster in Russia that had occurred decades earlier. And this is just kind of fallout from that. and but the sheep farmers in the nearby area were convinced that there had been recent changes and evidence of problems. So a couple of times the government dispatched scientists from London to the north of region of the country, out in the rural areas, and these expert scientists took their measurements and didn't find anything, so they concluded, you know, there's no problem. These farmers don't know what they're talking about. And they did this a few times. Ultimately, it emerged that the farmers did know what they were talking about. It was just that the times that the scientists had arrived were wrong ones for picking up on the problems. So the nuclear plant had been leaking. There was problems. And the kind of local knowledge of the sheep farmers had picked up on this in a way that the kind of expert scientists had not. So this is a kind of classic example of kind of local forms of knowledge that are not kind of institutionally ratified. They're not kind of valued by government or by institutions because the person doesn't have a PhD next to their name, but they are really important forms of knowledge. So this was a kind of key study that occurred in the 1980s and has kind of informed other subsequent studies have informed this shift away from this model of the public deficit and towards a model that focuses more on a two-way relationship between publics and experts. This shift has also been accepted within science education in schools in the UK. So there's been a shift away from focusing on just memorizing facts and instead understanding more the kind of processes that go into science, the kind of scientific process, the uncertainties that are inherent in scientific research, and less this kind of idea that there are hard facts that are true always and forever. So this new kind of model I've summarized here. It's the idea that, yes, there is public ignorance of science, but there's also ignorance in scientific institutions and in universities amongst experts, where there are many things we don't know about what's going on in the world. And so the problem is not ignorance per se, because we're all ignorant about certain things. And it's not the case that if only the public knew more information about things that they would be more supportive, because actually some researchers research has found the opposite relationship. So with genetically modified crops, for example, the more people know about it, the more opposed they are to it, according to some of the research. So it's a more complicated story, and the idea is that that there should be a sharing of knowledge, with public sharing their knowledge and scientific experts sharing their knowledge. So the idea is a more democratized notion of science. There should be more about dialogue, participation, and inclusivity of knowledges, meaning that you accept that people have valuable, general public have valuable knowledge to offer. And then the hope in terms of what would happen with the general public is that they would feel more engaged in science because they have something to contribute. And because we live in societies that are now heavily dependent on science and technology, it's really important for the general public to feel they can have an opinion about these issues, because they have a major effect on their lives. For example, decisions about whether certain kinds of research could happen, like genetically modified crops, that doesn't only affect the scientists who are doing that research. If genetically modified crop research is done, it potentially puts the entire kind of farm infrastructure at risk. And that's true for other kinds of scientific technologies as well. the decision to use nuclear power is accepting a risk on behalf of everybody who lives in that society, as the example in Japan with the Fukushima disaster shows. So that decision to have nuclear power plants spread all over Japan should have been a democratic decision, because everybody was taking on that risk, even though they didn't maybe recognize it at the time. It's a salient example for me, because I was in Japan and visited Fukushima last year, and they're still suffering from the from that. So here's another way of kind of looking at these different models for how communication between experts and publics can take place. So this comes from Alan Irwin, who's a sociologist of science. And so he identified three different types of ways of thinking about how to relate with publics if you're a scientific expert. The first order model of public communication focuses on creating greater interest amongst public in science, on trying to get the public to learn more about science and to see the scientist's perspective on things. And it does not require that scientists learn anything about publics. Yeah, this kind of model, this is the old model of we scientific experts know everything and the public know nothing, so we need to share some of the benefit of our knowledge for the public. The next type is a two-way dialogue, so an exchange of perspectives. Publics know things, experts know things, they should share perspectives. And then what he describes as third order is where the reflexivity, this kind of sense that there are uncertainties to science that need to be acknowledged, basically this in this model it's all integrated into society itself. So the kind of discussions about what kind of role we want science to play in society becomes just part of the general public's ways of thinking. And so the two perspectives, public and expert, become integrated through this kind of inherent reflexivity. This connects up with theoretical work by Ulrich Beck, the kind of risk society kind of arguments. So to kind of summarize where things are in terms of the UK context, also Europe in general, is that there's been a kind of shift towards the two-way model, exchanging perspectives in science policy, and this has been adopted at least officially by universities, museums, all the institutions that do this kind of work. And the goal is to create a kind of dialogue between experts and publics, and to go from a kind of this kind of communication where I tell you things to more of a dialogue where we both learn from each other. Now, one of the things I mentioned earlier was the idea of impact and how you measure and evidence impact. How do you know that any kind of communication with publics, whether it's the kind of one-way kind or whether it's a two-way dialogue, whether it's actually achieving anything. So this term impact has become used a lot in the UK in recent years, and it's something that's quite a key issue, is how do you measure this? And it can mean a number of things. It could mean learning, attitude changes, a whole range of different things, skill development, confidence, etc. Essentially, I think of this issue, I do a lot of research on impact, what's known as impact evaluation, where you measure how an intervention creates effects or doesn't. And I think of it in these terms. What difference has this made in people's lives, this intervention? Is there any kind of changes that have occurred in the ideas, relationships, interests, or motivations that people have as a result of this? And if so, what kinds of changes? And essentially, is there a difference between how people thought about an issue when you encountered them and how they think about it afterwards? And this is a very complex thing to do. It's not easy because there are many factors that affect whether impact will take place, including their kind of personal history, their kind of habitus in a Bourdieu sense, and the kind of context in which they encounter the information or the communication, what actually happened, and the kind of broader cultural and social context around it. So context plays a huge role in whether impact takes place. So in terms of measuring it, it's an important thing to keep in mind. And there's also a kind of complexity around the difference between what an institution wants to achieve, like a museum. If you imagine going to visit a museum, they have a kind of agenda for your visit that they would like to achieve. If you go, for example, to the National History Museum, they want to tell you some things about the history of Chile. And you arrive with your own agenda, whatever you wanted to achieve from going to that museum. Maybe it's just to kill 30 minutes because you are waiting to do something else, or because you're meeting a friend or whatever. It could be any number of agendas that could be quite different. So there has to be a kind of negotiation between whomever is doing the communication and the audience. And impact doesn't necessarily follow a kind of direct, immediate kind of pathway. So there are complexities there. And of course, any form of communication can have both positive and negative effects. If I give a very bad presentation, for example, I can probably make you dislike a topic after having heard it rather than improve it. So, and the same goes for if you imagine a bad visit to the National History Museum, you could be less interested in national history after having visited. And that's important to pick up in any form of impact evaluation. So, as I mentioned, I do a lot of this kind of research in different kinds of settings. So I was going to go through one example here from research at a science festival, and I don't think these are as common here. So a science festival is basically where usually it's run by a university or a set of universities, and they have scientists working at the university, often social scientists as well, who will they'll set up stands, kiosks, and they'll communicate about their research. So they'll tell the general public about recent findings from their research. Local institutions like museums will often get involved as well, and essentially it's a kind of short-term, maybe a week-long or even a couple of days event that tries to make a connection between the general public in a community and experts in that community. So before I go into this specific example, are there any comments, questions from what I've talked about so far? On the hybrid, taking two animals' genes and...
No. Hybrid forum?
Forum.
Yeah, it's like it's a methodology of... it's kind of the third kind of engagement of peer-to-peer. sort of thing, but it's actually a process you can do to when you have experts that know about something and non-experts that know about something but another imitates.
I'm not familiar with that particular format.
The second thing that you said was that when people know more about things, they could tend to actually dislike stuff and everything. But isn't it like an embedded or rooted kind of values, like the reactionary, precautionary divide, like that comes before that? Is it more about the knowledge or the engagement or the values that come before that?
That's kind of the point of the research, is that it's not, increasing knowledge is not in itself going to change people's views, because there are, people have values that decide kind of how they will respond to things. So once you know more about something, you might like it more, or you might dislike it more, but it's not the knowledge, it's not knowing it exists that creates your attitude change. It's your kind of existing orientation, and you kind of fit this new thing into your existing values.
So, like in the sort of third third engagement.
Yeah, third order. Yeah.
Third order. Right. Does it get like very political kind of engagement because of the values that are coming?
That's the. I mean, the idea is that the kind of core normative idea is that we should be deciding what to do based on our values. So it shouldn't be that we just kind of roll ahead with scientific development and technological development, just full steam ahead, just because we can. But that actually we kind of stop and think about, okay, yes, we could do any number of things. Let's focus our efforts on the things that are going to benefit society most, which is definitely not what's happening right now. So, right now, the focus is on what will create the most money. If you go down this kind of technological development route, you can create more income for the people who are doing that kind of research, as opposed to thinking about, you know, what will make the most difference in people's lives. So the kind of the ideal is to get to the point where science is seen as one of the things that we have a democratic opinion about, because it affects us both on the risk side and also on the benefit side. This is a normative position I'm committed to, personally, as well. I think it aligns quite well with a sociological perspective. Okay, so actually, how much time do we have?
You can go.
Sure. Yeah. So this particular, this is kind of a case example of an impact evaluation study on how people are responding to expert knowledge. So in this particular case, it's a science festival. So most of the people that, most of the experts involved would be actual scientists practicing, either university or industry scientists who are kind of presenting their ideas to the public in an informal setting. So the goal of this particular study was to find out who was going to this science festival in the north of England and what was happening, basically. So I did this using surveys, pre- and post-visit surveys. So I had research assistants at the different locations where the science festival was taking place, and they would stop people as they were coming in to ask them questions about themselves, as well as why they were coming, that kind of thing, why they were visiting. And then a follow-up survey was sent by email, online survey, after their visit. So the results revealed who was coming, both the kind of age profile of who was visiting, the ethnic profile, which was less diverse than the local population, so it was disproportionately white visitors, and Also, a key finding in terms of who was coming was that the level of education of people attending the science festival was heavily skewed towards highly educated people. So 75% of the people who came to the science festival had at least a bachelor's degree, undergraduate degree, and the UK population average is 24%. So there's a huge gap, a 50% gap. And similarly, there were a lot fewer people who came that had no qualifications at all than in the general population. So this is an important finding, that this is not how they frame these kinds of activities. These kinds of activities are supposed to be for the broader public and for bringing in people who are not already interested in science and creating a kind of dialogue with them. So just the factor of who was attending already showed that there was a problem. Like, it's not achieving what it's supposed to. And also, the income level was disproportionately high. 65% of them had incomes above the median for the UK. And this region is poorer than other parts of the UK, so it's particularly bad. In terms of the kind of perspective of people who were coming, a lot of them, it was quite clear that a lot of them were museum visitors. So they were kind of people who went to cultural events in general, and then they also came to this science event. And they were disproportionately people who thought science was interesting. So I had a Likert scale question, a level of agreement question that said science is boring, and only 2% agreed with that statement, and 88% disagreed. So this is that's not representative of the broader population. And then similar other questions, similar kind of pattern. So people were disproportionately interested in science already. I'm doing a journal article on this topic that the title is Preaching to the Scientifically Converted. For these kinds of events. So the people who came very much enjoyed the experience. There was strong agreement that they enjoyed it and that they would like to come again in the future. So it was very popular. People liked it. They thought the events were high quality and they enjoyed attending the events. They talked about their experience with their friends and family. And they tended not, actually, though, to talk as much to other people who went to the event. That's a kind of particularly British kind of result. And most of the people who went felt they were able to understand the kind of scientific topics that were discussed at the festival. One of the goals of the festival is to kind of give people the sense that they are scientific citizens, that they're able to understand science and engage in discussions about science topics. And so on that point, it seemed to go well. And there were patterns in terms of who was visiting. As I mentioned, disproportionately people were kind of heavy museum visitors in general that came to this event. So skipping to impact, the question of whether the festival made any difference in terms of people's attitudes about things related to science. So these were the things where it did make a difference. So I had a Likert scale statement, I am able to understand science, and 87% of visitors agreed with that beforehand, 92% agreed after, so there's a small increase in agreement with that. And then another statement was, science is a normal part of Manchester culture, so kind of seeing science as part of the community around them. And there's a pretty good size increase in that. And then many people agreed both before and after with the statement, I'm keen to learn more about science. So there were limited impacts. That's it. Those were the only effects on attitudes, and I asked a whole range of questions about a whole range of Likert scale statements about science and their attitudes about science. And mostly they stayed the same. They were unaffected by the experience, and they were very positive about it. So this is this was a very recent impact evaluation that I conducted, and I it was commissioned by the Museum of Science and Industry in this city that was the kind of lead partner for the festival. And so I presented these results to them and to all the partners who helped put on the festival, and basically told them that they were largely failing to achieve what they were trying to do. And to their credit, they actually listened and took it seriously, and they're actually trying to make some changes, be more inclusive, that kind of thing. But I do this quite often. I do a lot of commissioned studies, and I'm most of the time delivering bad news to them, saying, like at the National Gallery in London, the kind of one of the main kind of art museums in London, their audience was even more skewed towards highly educated people, and had absolutely no positive impacts on anybody. Well, you know, no statistically significant positive impacts. So it's in terms of this is kind of the thing that I do that's kind of out in the community, trying to make a difference to benefit society. And it's definitely a mixed story in terms of whether it actually makes a difference, because some institutions are not that interested in hearing how they're doing things wrong, and so they don't really listen, or they don't really make any changes, and then some do. So the story that I told in my impact case study was about some of the cases where they did listen, and they did make pretty fundamental changes in how they were approaching their audiences, and it had good effects in terms of doing things better. But it's an interesting area. I really enjoy having, you know, as an academic, it's quite nice to have a good chunk of my research be about practical issues where there are people who are more than just a kind of handful of other academics who are interested in the results, and there's at least some potential for impact that's much broader than just kind of academic discussions, which are also important to have as well. But my own view is that if we can, we should be trying to make a difference. So what are your views? that's it for my presentation. So your thoughts?
I have a few comments or questions.
Yeah, yeah.
What is about this notion of public engagement?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I do research on this, and I find it very sort of ambiguous and,
yeah,
and hugely under-specified notion, because it includes the list of things that you mentioned there, right? Just this kind of dialogue, deliberative thing, and but in some people also include under that notion of public engagement the idea of co-production of knowledge. And what's your name? Paolo mentioned, you know, Michel Calon's idea of hybrid forums, which is, it's kind of an umbrella concept, which is itself also very ambiguous, because it includes sort of consensus conferences, GM Nation, that sort of thing.
Okay.
But also these practices where people actually participate in the production of knowledge itself.
Okay.
Like patients of orphan diseases,
sure.
that kind of...
Sure.
So I wanted to know, what are your thoughts about that?
Actually, I've got an article on that exact topic that just came out recently. I'd be happy to send you in. It's basically in we tracked the kind of how this concept was developing in the UK, kind of in progress, because it's a relatively new concept.
Yeah.
It's about around 2000, the year 2000, this concept emerged. And initially it emerged with a much more specific meaning. It emerged as a meaning about a two-way dialogue. So it was a kind of in opposition to the kind of old way of like standing up, giving a lecture, kind of one way, pushing out messages. And then what happened is that over time, it it came to encompass everything, because it was seen as a better brand for what people were doing. So it was a lot easier to just take the label than it was to actually change practices. So in the study we did with a bunch of different kinds of public engagement practitioners in the UK, we found that they were quite quick to take the label and apply it to themselves. And it was only in a tiny percentage of cases that they actually saw it as requiring them to make changes in their practices. So by this point now, the meaning's been completely broadened out, so that it now includes absolutely any kind of communication between publics and experts. And I've stopped resisting it because it's so overwhelming that it's completely taken over. And now, if you want to distinguish between these different types of communication, you have to use terms like dialogue to refer to two-way communication. But that probably, too, will get taken over in time because there's a lot of resistance to changing
right.
practices.
So the other question was about to what extent is science festivals actually depart from the deficit model? You know, you mentioned the idea of the case of the sheep farmers that Brian Wynne talks about. Initially, he was one of the people insisting on that we have to abandon this, this deficit model and move to a. But he's nowadays very disappointed with this. So he claims that this deficit model is being reinvented over and over again, right?
Yeah,
so
he's right.
Census conference and. So, do you see this as a further instantiation of that?
It's less complicated than that, actually. For science festivals, they've always been about those first order goals, the kind of deficit model goals of promoting science, and they're still doing that. They just have taken the term and put it, you know, like they've taken the label without actually changing anything. So, but what Brian Wynne, his criticism is, what it applies to is how UK government has behaved, and he's been quite involved in UK government exercises where they're supposed to be reaching out to the public to get input on science policy rather than kind of government policy pushing decisions outwards. And the way that they go about that sounds very dialogical. They even use the term dialogue, once you dig deeper and deeper and deeper, once you get to the actual details of precisely exactly what did you do in that room, it's back to pushing knowledge. They make them sit through like a day of learning about the science before they'll listen to their views at all.
La forma como el mismo público que asiste a las ferias, o que en el fondo, como el mismo público, el legos o el no experto, entiende la ciencia en sí misma. En general, en el colegio, o a las personas con menor educación, lo que se les enseña es el hecho. La ciencia funciona en base a hechos. Por lo tanto, no puede existir un ciudadano científico si es que no está la posibilidad del ciudadano de criticar aquello que está haciendo. En ese sentido, la feria no funciona en ese modo, sino que más bien funciona en el modo de te estamos mostrando la ciencia para que una vez que tú aprendas todo esto, puedas hacer como tener una influencia sobre la ciencia respecto a lo que para poder conversar con los otros. Pero eso encuentro que es como una forma falsa de hacer realmente democracia científica.
Sí, sí, es verdad. There's a problem with the public doesn't know, like doesn't understand this dialogue model. It doesn't really make sense to them. In fact, so I've done research on how there was a series of public dialogue activities that I evaluated, and they wanted to be told. They wanted information. They didn't really have a concept of what it would be to have a dialogue. This should not be coming from school level, because in the UK the curriculum was supposed to have changed at least 12 or 13 years ago to be more focused on debate and dialogue. And so it is possible to have this kind of dialogue. It requires a different kind of structure. And the problem is that the people running these exercises, these kinds of public dialogue activities, tend to follow a kind of traditional structure of your opinion is not at all valid until I fill you up with some knowledge. So the term they use is informed citizens. So they want to listen to informed citizens, which basically means have some knowledge first, and then you can say something. But that's quite problematic.
En ese mismo sentido, creo que el punto en donde las personas realmente se transforman en como ciudadanos de la ciencia en el sentido de una de democratización es cuando los efectos de la ciencia efectivamente los tocan a niveles más personales, en el sentido de, por ejemplo, si yo tuviese una antena de celulares cerca de mi casa, y yo noto que después de la construcción de esa antena constantemente tengo dolores de cabeza, por ejemplo, automáticamente yo iría a tratar de solucionar mi problema, aunque la ciencia me diga que no existe ningún efecto de la antena sobre mi cerebro. En ese sentido creo que habría que hacer un cambio, no tanto en la forma como se presentan en las exposiciones, por ejemplo, sino más bien dejar que las personas entren dentro del proceso no de investigación, pero sí de evaluación de proyectos sociales a gran escala. Y eso en Chile es muy, muy bajo lo que se hace. Todavía todo el ambiente de gobierno público tiene la idea de necesitamos datos para poder hacer la mejor política pública, y no necesitamos datos para luego ver cómo mediamos o cómo hacemos un diálogo con las personas. En el fondo, más bien a mí me parece que los ciudadanos en este caso son una molestia para el Estado más que algo que realmente sea parte del proceso. Es como, tenemos que lidiar con estas personas porque nos están molestando, porque nosotros queremos hacer esto, que nosotros sabemos por la ciencia que es bueno. Entonces es como interesante ese diálogo.
All of those things are true. So there is an issue with how the knowledge comes to exist, and so there have been efforts to give people more power to be able. There have been some recent examples I've seen. For example, in New York, there was a canal that was very badly polluted in a particular neighborhood, and they couldn't get any evidence that it was polluted, so nobody was doing anything about it. So year after year after year, it just stayed really bad. And recently they had they did a kind of community-based project to gather evidence of this pollution. No scientists, no university scientists showing up, just the community was able to access low-cost technology that let them measure the pollution, and then they publicized it, and it was accepted as evidence by the Environmental Protection Agency in the U.S., and it's been designated a polluted site and is now getting cleaned up. So there is a possibility for kind of empowering communities that have a specific problem to be able to access scientific, to produce scientific knowledge themselves to get that fixed. It's not 100% solution, but that's one element. The other issue of people not really caring enough, they can't really be bothered to take an interest, that's definitely an issue. People don't realize how much it affects them and the kind of the role that science is playing and the risks that all of us are being exposed to just because somebody somewhere thinks it's good for their career to do it. So this is kind of an awareness issue to kind of highlight that this is something we should care about in a democracy. And so it comes down to education, ideally starting in the schools, to try to create this kind of sense of citizen science, of scientific citizens. So, yeah, those are both key issues. I think you mentioned something else, though. There's a third thing, or does that address? Yeah, I think it's quite interesting, this kind of the possibility of empowering people to gather their own scientific evidence so that they don't have to rely on scientists. It's quite an interesting move. Yeah.
I was thinking about three examples of citizen participation.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is the couple actions science, like a performative manner of thing, like bullying. I think bullying is a good example.
Okay.
Bullying is in social science construction, and then is in society now, and all like, in the state, in our way. Talk about bullying.
Is it a social science construction?
Yeah. It's like for Orwell's. Orwell's is a. Not only bullying, like familial violence, for example, is another, like a social science construction than then is in society.
Sure.
But I have, that's one example.
Mm-hmm.
Another example is like city science. Like citizen science.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know if you know, Galaxy Zoo.
Yeah.
Well, this is another way of production of science that people actually can participate in the research process.
Yes.
So.
Although I think it's examples like Galaxy Zoo, and so there's this concept of citizen science where publics directly participate in scientific research, also social science research. And I think that's less important than is suggested, because it's a very circumscribed role that the public have in there.
So that's
free labor.
Yeah,
right?
they get the benefit of being free labor for for scientists.
So that's actually my question.
Okay. Yeah.
What is your opinion about which kinds of like participation of citizens? Could actually do.
Well, there's a third kind. You mentioned two kinds of interactions, but the third is where publics participate in defining directions for research.
Particularistic problems that the community have.
There's a whole range. Yeah, so one of it is saying here are some problems that we have that we think should be addressed. Another, though, is that's been done in the UK is where the government funding agency says there are a whole range of things we're thinking about funding. What are your views on what's most important or what you think should not be done? And so this was done when they were deciding what to fund for research on nanotechnology, the kind of super small kinds of technology. And they decided not to fund one element of the research because the public response was very negative to that element. That was looking at ways to use nanotechnology for weaponry, for creating more sophisticated ways of killing people. they decided not to fund that, although I suspect they just moved the funding over to the Ministry of Defense. That's an example too of like upstream. It's called upstream public engagement in the literature. I have a PhD student who's actually focusing on this topic and the role of media in this kind of early form of engagement. So you can have input at the level of funding. So before even asking for ideas from academics. You can have input at the level of the community saying we have problems that we need solved, and there are examples of doing that. And then also at the level of the individual research project, it's possible to involve non-experts in that process. Where this has happened most, that I cases I know of, is in medical contexts. So like patients directly participating in defining research questions, as well as the details of how the research takes place. So I know that's happened, but I actually know somebody quite well who does that kind of research, and she could not explain to my satisfaction precisely how that took place. Because my concern is that it still is dominated by the expert, researcher, and that it ends up being quite a small, relatively tokenistic role for the public. So finding a way to, I mean, co-production of knowledge is one way of describing this, but finding a way to give lay publics, non-experts, full power and voice in the process is something that's still ongoing. There are different models that are being tried in different places, particularly in places like the UK and the United States, or where I know of examples of this. But it's kind of ongoing, the kind of finding the best model for doing this. But there is acceptance, at least in the UK, that this is something we should be doing, that we shouldn't be just kind of sitting in an office in a university deciding what the most important research to be done is, just because I feel like it, or because I, you know, I think it's interesting. That that's not good enough anymore. Just because I think it's interesting shouldn't justify investing in that direction. It should be connecting up something bigger.
I guess, sort of, just from my biased perspective, right? It's a distinction between what we call like solicited engagement and unsolicited engagement, right? Because you said that people need to be empowered, but you could say that they can also empower themselves, right? And that's what I find interesting about this. Groups of lay people that learn the science by themselves, for themselves, and end up, you know, publishing in scientific journals or so.
That's very rare.
In order
rare.
To move their own agenda. In the, so there are cases of this, right?
I know, but very rare.
Yeah, very rare. But that's a democratic treasure.
Rara ave, is that the expression?
What?
Rara ave? Rara ave? Rara ave?
What?
No, never mind. It was a new expression I thought I learned. Rare bird. No importa.
But he's saying about unsolicited and solicited. There's like also some people that are talking about like civil duty on science, like an obstacle footer or something that is very.
You know, he's my colleague.
Yeah. And he's very like the fractionary principle and. All the people should experiment in them and just go forward on that. I don't know how you take on that. Like, do you think that public information can go as far as that, or are you more like, I don't know, it should be more.
Actually, I haven't read his book. Summarize, could you summarize the point?
Which one?
The Proactionary.
Oh, no, I haven't read the last one.
Okay.
But I attended his class. I was there.
Oh, okay.
And, and the thing is that he's very into like saying things like we should. He gives an example about vitamins, and how they were widely developed through like experimenting on people, and that people were okay with that because it was a progress for everyone. So he's very much into this, not public engagement, but rather civil duty sort of. To
so do it all, and
yeah.
and do it now.
He's pretty right.
Yeah. Steve Fuller is a polemicist. He makes big claims that are not very defensible in general. But on this particular one, obviously that's not very defensible to just say like do it all the time. As I mentioned, I take the view that we need to review and decide which things to do through a kind of democratic process of deciding what will be most beneficial for society. So not just kind of doing it all. And that some things we shouldn't do, definitely, and some things we should.
Right, and the other
yeah.
is like, when you talk about this democracy and this divide between experts and non-experts, is it useful that divide to be put a priori? Because, I mean, I don't know if you've read Rancière, Jacques Rancière.
No.
Okay, he has a book that's called The Ignorant Schoolmaster, where he talks about the divide between professor and student.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now that idea of ignorance is played like a priori,
mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
to give power to the teacher,
mm-hmm.
and take power from the student.
Sure.
And he goes along with a story about a French guy named Jacques, who actually saw this rare occasion where he gave to a group of students that didn't speak French, like a version of the, I don't know what's the name, Telemachus. Telemachus? Okay, Telemachus is a Greek.
Okay, cool.
Okay. That was translated in Greek, French, and Dutch, I think. So he told them, okay, learn from that, and we'll talk later. Like, and they actually learned French. That's the claim. So
okay.
he said, okay, so there's no divide a prioristically, but rather it is a political device, actually, to generate power. So is it useful, the idea of expert and non-expert beforehand?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that's, again, kind of an exaggerated argument, because you're right, there is, in terms of like some kind of objective, permanent status, obviously expert and non-expert is a kind of contextual judgment. It depends on the particular context. So if I'm standing in a, you know, in an engineering convention, I'm not an expert anymore. You know, so it depends. You know, the last few days I've been meeting with museums and zoos here in Santiago, and for them, for the particular topic of researching their visitors, I am an expert because I know more about it than they do and how to do it. So yes, it's a situational, contextual judgment. It's not a kind of real status in the sense that it's permanent and it attaches to me no matter where I go. I think it is a relevant distinction. Knowing more about something or less about something is one variable that is relevant to what plays out in that social setting. Yes, it has a political dimension, and certainly within institutions, that's particularly evident, that you need to establish power as a kind of major factor. But just because power is involved doesn't mean that that's the only thing involved. I mean, this is part of the problem with Foucault's argument, is yes, knowledge is power, but it's not only power. I would not accept that. Argument. What was the second part of your?
No,
that's it. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you go in the middle, like very radical, reactionary, non very radical democratization of knowledge. Very like, yeah.
Yeah. I would say reasonable. Middle, sure.
Aristotelian.
Do you make a difference between a scientist, an expert, or an engineer, or applied study, or something? Because in this discussion, I feel like there's like a mix in the sort of the expert, the academic, the scientist.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that an expert is in relation to his context.
Mm.
But if we focus on the scientist and his methodology, or just mention one way of finding a scientist,
mm-hmm.
I don't think that depends too much on the context. So, do you make a difference between all these figures?
Yes, in the sense that if I was doing a study in that particular setting, there would be different factors involved. But no, in the sense that similar theoretical issues are involved. So, whether it's kind of practical knowledge or whether it's theoretical knowledge, that's not so important for these kind of issues about how you think about the communication of that knowledge. It is important in terms... One of the factors, actually, that I haven't mentioned that is really important is institutionally ratified expertise. So there's a distinction between being an expert and being an expert that's recognized by institutions in your particular context. So in the UK, I'm a recognized expert in social science research because of my position in a university. I have a friend who's not in a university who knows quite a lot about statistics and is able to do research and publishes that research in peer-reviewed journals, but he's not in a university, and so he's not a recognized expert in social science research in the same way. And so that recognition and that kind of that does matter quite a lot in terms of the sociological consequences of what happens when you have engagement between experts and non-experts. So that's a kind of power status issue, whether your expertise is recognized by an institution, whether you have a degree or a certificate that says you have this knowledge, you have this expertise, or whether it's just based on your practical experience. That can affect the process of communication.
Thank you very much, Eric.
Thank you, everybody. Thanks for your contributions. Really interesting.